G.I. Joe, the Real American Headcast, is the code name for Aaron's daring, highly trained headcast. Its purpose? To podcast about G.I. Joe, Fighting Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
Welcome back to G.I. Joe, a Real American Headcast. Here we are with Episode 7, and once again, I am joined by Mr. Ryan Daly. Hey there, Ryan.
How's it going?
Doing good. And it sounds like maybe he's over the bubonic plague. We have Mr. Kyle Benning. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Glad to see you among the land of the living.
Yeah.
So excited. I guess you and the whole family were sick last time, a week or so that me and mine was sick.
Yep, I was bummed to miss out on those, but you guys did a great job without me, so I guess I'm not feeling too needed right now.
And our fourth co-conspirator is still working on his weather dominator. He says he's waiting on Death Star to bring over a left-handed smoke shifter, so maybe he's still building, who knows. So it's just going to be the three of us tonight, so we're going to go and cover issue 7 of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero. And Mr. Benning, I believe you have the synopsis on this issue.
Yes, I do. This time out, we have G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 7, that according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, went on sale October 12, 1982. The script, and script only, was by Larry Hama. It's plotted and penciled by Herb Trimpe. Inks by longtime Marvel anchor Chick Stone. Letters by Jim Novak. Colors by Christy Scheel. And the editor was Denny O'Neill. The cover is also by Trimpe and Stone, and shows G.I. Joe member Stalker and October Guard member Colonel Brekoff standing back-to-back, firing at an army of Cobra troopers. The story opens where issue number 6 left off, in the mountains of Afghanistan, where a small team of G.I. Joes comprised of Stalker, Scarlet, Steeler, Flash, Clutch, and Breaker have fought their Russian counterparts, the October Guard, comprised of Stormovic, Shreg, Horshow, Dana, and Colonel Brekoff, to a standstill, only to be overwhelmed by Cobra Commander and a small army of his Cobra Commandos. Cobra is intent on claiming the remnants of a top-secret Soviet aircraft that had crashed in the Hindu Kush foothills as their prize. Cobra Commander and his forces head off with the Soviet fighter, Jet in tow, leaving the Joe and October Guard teams in the hands of two Cobra Elite, Rattler and Copperhead, for torture and execution. Of course, this backfires as Clutch lives up to his codename and kills their would-be attackers via a hidden remote control gun mount unit. After the Russians and Americans overcome their language barrier, they decide to join forces and track down Cobra, thanks to a tracking device placed on the plane by Breaker. Tracking Cobra takes the combined Joe and Guard teams across the Iranian border, where they are engaged by an Iranian border control. The skilled Russian and American operatives use their superior training and skill to make up for their inferior numbers and make short work of the Iranian Guard. They continue their trek into Iran, following the signal from Breaker's hidden tracker, and they soon locate Cobra's stronghold. After examining the building with recon from afar, Steeler can't make out any discernible entrance, prompting Stalker to strap on the jump jetpack and perform air reconnaissance, which catches the attention of Cobra. However, Stalker is able to make sense of the maze-like top of the structure, resulting in an attack plan. Steeler, Breaker, and Flash will scour the roof. Stalker, Scarlet, and Flash will penetrate from the north wall, with Clutch guarding the outside. The October Guard members, Colonel Brekoff, Dana, and Horshow, will enter through the south while Stormovic watches. Cobra's defenses make short work of the rooftop attack team and Clutch, leaving just the Joe team of Stalker, Scarlet, and Flash attacking from the north. They see an entrance open for them, and despite knowing that it's a trap, they proceed through the entrance while realizing that they've lost contact with the rest of their team and now are on their own. During the course of their penetration, they encounter several booby traps, shafts that come out of the wall, a trip that releases a slab of concrete, a rage of water that almost led the team to a sinkhole, in a den of King Cobras. Luckily, Flash disarms this threat with his trusty laser. Stalker eliminates a group of Cobra soldiers with a grenade, and they finally reach their prize, the RTV with the remnants of the Russian spy plane. However, their Russian counterparts, the October Guard team of Brekov, Dana, and Horshow, beat them to the location. With their tenuous treaty over, Brekov tells the Joes to surrender their weapons, much to Cobra Commander's delight. He's more than willing to once again let the American and Russian forces duke it out for the spy plane. However, one of the Cobra troopers is actually Clutch in disguise. That turns the tide, and it appears that the Joes have the upper hand, and they plan to leave with both the spy plane and Cobra Commander as their hostage. Refusing to be upstaged, Colonel Brekov guns down Cobra Commander. But in a twist only M. Night Shyamalan could have seen coming, the hostage wasn't the real Cobra Commander, but instead a robot doppelganger. Seriously, why doesn't Cobra just get rich off his patents for his super advanced robotic technology? Anyways, sick of betrayals and double crosses, the Joes escape and leave the guard to deal with the remaining Cobra forces. The Joes make it back, and Stalker declares the mission a success. Hawk congratulates them, but tells them the truth that the real spy plane had already been airlifted out of Afghanistan. They were merely hauling literally scrap and acted as a decoy, leaving the Joe shocked. The end.
Okay. And I don't have a lot of notes this issue. Ryan, what do you think about this?
Well, I think we were both pretty strong on the last issue, number 6, with this setup for this the conflict and eventual team-up between the Joes and the October Guard. And I felt a little bit underwhelmed by this one, by the second part, the concluding half of it. It's not bad. It just feels like it's sort of all over the place. One of the notes that I had, while Herb Trimpe is still the penciler for this one, I don't know if he was rushed for a deadline or what it was, but I think the art is a little bit sloppy in some places. I'm trying to think, did Chick Stone, had he edited any of these issues before, or was this his first time on the book?
I want to say this is his first time.
Maybe that has to do with it. Maybe it's a new inker. But I just thought, like, the art, especially towards the back end of the book, was a little bit sloppy. What did you think, Kyle?
Yeah, I agree with the sentiment that it might have been a little rushed. It seemed to be to start out fairly strong and then kind of seemed to get that more rushed look as you get deeper and deeper into the book. I don't think Stone had inked Trimpe yet on G.I. Joe, but I want to say he inked him at least at some point during his Hulk run. I mean, Chick Stone was one of the early staple of Marvel inkers that Marvel used. I know he had, I want to say, was it maybe Thor that he had inked Kirby on before in the really early days of Marvel. So he'd been around forever, just like Trimpe had been at this point at Marvel. So I actually really like the opening splash page. We get Cobra's backside and then the combined ranks of G.I. Joe and October Guard facing us. Then there's the nice little text box recapping to bring the readers up to speed. But that said, kind of what's going on with the background characters there? I believe those are all supposed to be like hordes of Cobra troopers, but instead with how the details are drawn in, they look more like generic ranks of G.I. Joe or October Guard members.
They don't have the face masks. They seem to have like camouflage patterns. Yeah, those look like they could be Joes.
So I wonder if that's all on Chick Stone, the inker. I mean, especially if Trimpe was rushed, you don't think he would have penciled in all those details, especially since he's kind of the one plotting the story. So you would hope he had that right. So
right.
I'm kind of going to lay that on Chick Stone's feet.
Yeah, just I agree with both you guys that it's not bad, but it's just not, especially like say me and Ryan was, loved the last issue, but this one here is just not quite as, something's just not quite as good with this for some reason.
It feels, the plot takes a weird direction. You know, last episode felt very much like a kind of realistic, grounded military story with them going to Afghanistan, with dealing with the kind of local geopolitical system of what's going on in these mountains, dealing with the tenuous situation with these Russian soldiers. And here we get this weird kind of like pyramidal base that they have to infiltrate with all of these death traps and booby traps. This feels like the ending to a completely different story. And I wonder if there was, some sort of editorial interference, or if Larry Hama just wasn't, just didn't know what direction he was taking the book. I mean, it is worth noting, like, after this issue, Hama is off the book for 2 issues. So maybe Herb Trimpey was late, and that's why the book seems rushed, but Herb Trimpey is on the next couple of issues, so maybe the problem was Larry Hama. Maybe he was late getting the story done, and that's why it's kind of all over the place and the art looks a little bit rushed.
Well, and that makes me kind of wonder what the real trade-off was, because Trimpey's listed as plotter, and Hama's just listed as scripter. So I'm kind of curious what working relationship they had on this issue as far as the writing goes.
Right. And the weird kind of, sci-fi nature, the more of the James Bond type of crazy adventure aspect seems more in line with the type of stories that Trimpey does when he's writing it himself.
Yeah. So do you remember, was Trimpey the... Was he credited as a plotter of, was it issue 3 or 4 where they had essentially the Trojan horse that was the robot that was disassembled? Because that one sticks out as the other kind of sci-fi story we've covered so far.
No, that one, he was only credited as pencils.
I mean, that said, when Larry Hama did pitch this, it was originally kind of a overhauled take on S.H.I.E.L.D. So,
right.
I think a lot of those spy elements probably would have been those James Bond elements probably seeded in those first year's worth of stories.
Right. Trimpey did get a plotting credit on issue 4, which is one where they go to the cult with the Operation Wingfield or whatever it is.
Oh yeah, that's right. The Montana militia.
Right.
He was also a plotter last issue.
Oh, was he?
Trimpey was.
Yeah, Herb Trimpey, I forgot, he was the plotter penciler last issue and this issue, with Larry being the scripter. And I say that next issue, it's just Herb, and then the following issue is Steve Grant, where Larry Hama rejoins us, so...
Yeah,
maybe Larry was having some personal issues or something and needed some help with it, maybe? I don't know, maybe...
I'd be interested to see, I'm sure it'd be tough picking Hama's brain, 30 years later or anything, but and unfortunately Trimpey's no longer with us, but be curious to just kind of hear about their working relationship. I mean, obviously when you think of G.I. Joe, Ham is the first thing that pops into mind. I mean, he wrote most of the file cards and everything, and obviously wrote the vast majority of the series, but I wonder how much of the early elements and kind of character development came from Trimpey. I think most people probably look at it as G.I. Joe being the sole creation of Hama, since it was kind of based off of his original pitch around that overhauled S.H.I.E.L.D. take.
Right.
But I'm curious what other elements Trimpey brought to the table, because he was at least writing a good chunk of these early stories, so he's definitely right up there as a co-creator of the series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd be curious if I could ever get a chance to talk with Larry. I'd be curious if he remembers... Again, like you guys are saying, it's been 30 years, maybe not have memories exactly what happened 30 years ago, but...
Yeah, and I mean, it feels like we don't really get deep kind of characterization and continuity until around issue 10. That's the first time that we start learning about Snake Eyes' backstory, and that's when the writing sort of changes, and we get these longer storylines.
Yeah. More of the Springfield.
Yeah, the first 8 or 9 episodes, they're very, I mean, at least this one is a 2-parter, this is the second half, but these are very self-contained stories that could be read in any order. And the characters a lot of times are sort of interchangeable, but what did you guys think about the relationship the scene where Stalker has to negotiate this agreement, this working truce with the Russians? And how Scarlet is against the idea of teaming up.
Yeah, I do have a comment about that. It's very 80s. I mean, Russia's our enemy, and you can see that through Scarlet's. Whereas, was it last issue, the issue before that with Stalker? I think it was last issue where Stalker was, he's willing to do what needs to get done, and he's very much a soldier that, he follows orders and he does whatever it takes to get the job done. So I myself didn't have a problem with that. I saw Scarlet very much as an American standpoint, the dirty Russians and...
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a really nice bit of character development for both Stalker and Scarlet, but also kind of a, a nice little realistic touch of what you'd really kind of expect on this team. I mean, you're taking essentially the best that all the branches of the American military have to offer. So, I mean, these people are probably used to coming from some sort of leadership position. They're used to kind of being the head honcho or the top dog. I mean, that's why they're elite. So obviously you're going to have a little bit of a clash between personalities and what decision they want to go with. I think the whole thing could have been avoided if Breaker hadn't opened his big mouth here. You kind of want to slap him. I mean, especially then Scarlet challenges Stalker here, and then she's backed instantly by Breaker. Well, you know, if he hadn't opened his big mouth and said, "Hey, I put a tracker on the device, we can follow it," in front of the Russians, they could have pulled a tactical retreat and then secretly gone after it themselves. He kind of opened his big mouth, and at that point they really didn't have any other choice but to say, yeah, we'll team up with you guys. At that point, I couldn't help but think it really would have been handy to have that temporary Joe member, Rocky Balboa, on the team during that scene. You know, he could have given the whole, "You know, if I can change, and you can change, we can all change" speech, and everything would have been great. It would have been all smoothed over, and the Cold War would have ended, you know, 5 years earlier.
Good times.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
I think I'm a little higher on it than you guys. I love the October Guard. That stems from one of my first Joe figures, and one of my most beloved was a Colonel Breckoff figure. Much different design than what he has here. The figure I have, he's got a green uniform and then the Russian stereotypical hat with a red star and then a red beard. So quite a bit of a different appearance than what he has in here. But I've always loved the October Guard. And I thought Hammond's script had some nice elements to it. On page 3, when you have the Cobra executors, essentially, Copperhead and Rattler, they have a pretty sick and twisted dialogue exchange for a kid's comic. Say something like, "Let's not be hasty. I suggest we start with the kneecaps and work upwards." That's pretty cold-blooded.
I guess this is the first Copperhead. Because later on, there's going to be the driver of the water moccasin. If I'm not mistaken, his name's Copperhead also.
Yeah,
that's.
I mean,
go ahead. They seem like kind of throwaway names, but Larry and Hasbro would end up recycling them a few years later.
That's what I was going to say. They were
vehicle. Right.
Yeah, they're just essentially Cobra officers. I mean, they look very much in line with the Cobra officer first wave figure there. But, yes. You know, really showing that these guys really are a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world. And then at the bottom of that page 3, you have – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah. Well, I was going to mention that although that is sort of the first indication of what will happen with Cobra, in that they use all these versions of Snake names for their vehicles and their characters. Because at this point, all we had was Cobra Commander, Cobra Officer, Cobra Trooper from like the action figure line in the comics. Like, we hadn't been introduced to anybody else with these names. So this is kind of the first time Larry and Hasbro would do that.
That's true, yeah. We haven't seen any Vipers show up yet.
Right.
And then at the bottom of page 3 there, on the last panel, you have a nice little geography joke about the two different Georgias. Made me chuckle.
And a repeating jokes about song titles with the Georgia on my mind with Ray Charles' song. And then Breckoff comes back, but the Georgia on my mind is back in the USSR. It's like, oh, God.
Yep.
How many times are we going to pound these song title puns into our head?
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the issue. It just wasn't as good as the last issue. And I do like the October Guard and the way that they were introduced in here. Again, I'm a big fan of the October Guard. I don't think they were used often enough. But I was coming to the cover on, I like the cover on this one. What do you guys think about the cover? I mean, I know this was the, if I'm not mistaken, this was the cover one of the digests that I actually owned.
Yes, I believe the cover was repurposed for the digest. I do dig this cover. It's one of the, I mean, fairly simple. There's a lot of negative space in there that, with the red and kind of the firefight in the black background. But I think it's so far one of the best covers we've seen. It's certainly beats the cover to, God, what was it? issue 5 or something that had the Bob Hall cover where they were all goofy running towards the reader.
Oh yeah, that was issue 4.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, I made like a top 10 list of my favorite G.I. Joe covers, just for like an exercise for myself. And this cover made the top 10. I really, really like this cover. I like the spirit of it. I like the aesthetic of it, like with them two soldiers back to back, even though they're on opposite ends of the war, they're both fighting the common enemy. I love the hell out of this cover.
And the very much would be like a 80s action movie, movie poster you could see.
Oh, very much so. You've got the blurbs on there. A moment ago they were enemies. Now they fight together against the greatest evil in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very 80s. in a good way.
I really like it's after the moments where we were talking about when the Joes and the October Guard team up. It's like a 2/4 page splash of all the Joes packed into their Jeep, the Vamp, and the October Guard in one of their vehicles.
Right.
I love how that Jeep has a GIJ2 stamped on the front bumper.
And then the page after that, this was something that that Aaron and I talked about in the last episode. Trimpy does a sort of cinematic flourish with his panel breakdowns, in that he keeps the camera or the panel, essentially our lens, on a fixed point, which is like 10 feet behind the Vamp, and just changes the background to give us this sense of movement as they're just plowing through basically the Iranian army, just gunning them down. This, like, you know, this patrol in order to get to their location.
Yeah, I really like that. Yeah, that was a great point that I enjoyed hearing you guys discuss in the last episode. On the page right after that, I got a real big flashback to being a kid when Stalker puts on the jump jetpack.
Mm-hmm.
That just instantly made me think of one of the toy commercials there where they'd start off animated, and then they had the two kids playing with all the action figures on like the sweetest like mountain looking playset ever. They had like the rope bridge and everything. And I swear that Stalker had a jetpack in the animated portion in one of those commercials. And so the instant I saw that panel there, I think it's the bottom of page 8, the last two panels, it just kicked me back to playing that commercial again in my head.
Yeah, no, I like the anytime. I think we talked about this one in the earlier podcast. I like you guys. I enjoy whenever Stalker shows up in the jetpack. It seems half the time whenever the jetpack's being used, you can find Stalker in it. And at the very end of this, you jump ahead a little bit, but I do like that we find out, because again, I remember last issue we were talking about, it took me back for a minute finding out that Hawk was the mole, and here we find out why. You know, he was just saying that the team up is a decoy, and so that's why he was giving away their information to Cobra, so, you know, distract him from the real mission. I thought that was a nice touch.
It's a really weird moment that I don't think they ever come back to. It feels like Larry Hama was trying to make, because a lot of times he'll use these stories to make kind of a commentary about life in the military and how the soldiers do their job and they don't always know what the purpose is. You know, like ours is not to ask why, ours is but to do and die, that type of thing. And it just feels like it's such a weird kind of forced moment. I mean, the fact that the leader would be selling out this information of the mission, compromising his soldiers, putting them in danger for this retrieval, it feels unnecessarily complicated.
Especially given the risk involved with these guys being, you know, however many there was, 5 or 6 of your most elite unit of soldiers that at the U.S. government's disposal, and you're really putting them in a pointless situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he picked some of the best. He knew that, you know, if he just had regular Joes, if you will, into the, you know, the same situation, they probably wouldn't fare as well as the top of the line. So maybe that's why, knowing, you know, that this whole mission is just a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
They figure, you know, the best chance of the men surviving is petting the best in there.
The second to last page, the final panel, when Dana or Diana tries to get on the Vamp with them, and Stalker stiff arms her.
Are you looking over my shoulder, Ryan? I'm looking at that page myself right now. It's going to comment on that.
It's
that's a great Walter Payton stiff arm. He puts exactly. that on her jaw.
It's so the art and the panel. That is
rough.
Well, it. The thing is,
I kind of wondered when Commandy showed up, but
yeah, I was going to say like there are a couple times in this two-parter where it looks like they're channeling Jack Kirby. Like, there's one panel in issue 6 that I think we forgot to talk about where Colonel Brekhov is running forward with, like, a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and his gun in his arms, and that looks like something straight out of a Kirby War comic or Captain America or something. This one, again, looks like something out of the 50s or 60s. There's much more of a cartoonish style. I love the moment, the fact that she's trying to get on and Stalker's just like, nope, and just paps her right in the face with his hand, with his open hand. It's funny, but it's like, who drew this? This looks nothing like the rest of the book.
Who did the panel before that when Diana's running towards the vehicle? And
That looks right out of a Sergeant Fury.
Mm-hmm.
The panel before that, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, the way her hair, I don't know, just looks very, very odd there.
Yeah.
But I like what they're doing with it, but yeah, I don't know if it was his artwork on it or if it was Inker.
I think it's probably a little bit of the combination there with Herb's early artistic stuff was definitely Kirby inspired, especially when he took over the Hulk. And then Chick Stone, likewise, I'm pretty sure inked Kirby a decent amount in the 60s. And he might have even followed Kirby over to DC on some of his stuff. But I think Stone, both of them had a past history of a little bit of that Kirby inspiration or emulating that style. And it just seemed to stars align just right on a couple panels where you really see that Kirby influence shine through. I mean, even the panel, it'd be the page facing it, you see like that pipe sticking out there. That's very much Kirby line style on that pipe coming through there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the type of shading you'd see on some sort of device out of a New Gods comic.
Yep.
Very much so.
Or a sewer layer of Hydras.
Which is very fitting, I guess, but... So much I didn't hate this issue, it just wasn't as good as what we've been getting for the most part. And again, the art was very hit or miss. Do you guys have any other thoughts on this issue? Anything we didn't mention yet?
No, I mean, I love the cover. I think the cover is the best one that we've gotten so far.
Yeah.
But the story is... It's not the worst. It's not the best. Just sort of, like I said, I really liked issue 6, and I felt like this one was kind of an underwhelming conclusion.
And I think that may be part of the problem with this issue, is that we enjoyed 6 so much, and while this isn't a bad issue, following 6, it makes it seem worse than it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have any other thoughts on this, Kyle?
Nope. It's still, yep, I mean... We've gotten some pretty strong issues so far, so it's not as strong as some of those, but it's still fairly enjoyable action romp, and the art, even in the weak points, is still fairly serviceable to the story, but it's still a pretty enjoyable, fun read. Not too bad for a 60-cent cover price.
Yeah, and like I said, we're 7 issues into a new series, and I mean, for 7 issues in, like I said, I got issue 4, the Operation Wingfield was... the worst out of the bunch, so beyond that one, I think the rest of them have been pretty good, so...
I think I also did the synopsis for that one, so I always pick the winners to synopsize here. And I can't even say I was forced into them, because I volunteered for both of those, so...
That's just bad luck.
Yeah. Well, unless there's something else we're missing, I guess we'll go ahead and take a break, and we'll play some... podcast commercials, and we'll be right back with the animated series. Be right back, guys.
G.I. Joe will return after these messages.
Aw, yeah. Aw, yeah. Feels good.
Feels good.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, greetings and hi there. This is the Head Speaks Podcast. Hey there, true believers. Welcome to the Task Force X Headcast. G.I. Joe, the Real American Headcast, is the code name for Aaron's daring, highly trained headcast.
Hello there, my name is Aaron Moss, and this is the Starman Manhunter Adventure Hour.
Hello, my name is Alexis Mox. This is my show called Alexis Beat.
And all of these shows can be found on the Headcast Network. Look for it on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Also on Facebook by looking for the Headcast Networks. All of the great headcasts that you love on one convenient feed. Look for it. The Headcast Network. See you there.
Do you want to hear the origin of Superman or Batman? Of course not. You're listening to a Geek Culture podcast. You know the origins of Superman and Batman. You've always known them. Your unborn grandchildren know the origins of Superman and Batman. But what about Guy Gardner, Blue Beetle, or the Phantom Stranger? What about Firestorm, Sandman, or the Golden Age Fury? Those are just a few of the stories covered in the Secret Origins podcast, a review show dedicated to the Secret Origins comic published by DC in the 1980s. Each episode of the Secret Origins podcast features me, Ryan Daly, and an all-star collection of guest hosts revealing or revisiting the legends of the DC superheroes and villains. And if you're already sick of hearing my voice on this promo, the good news is at least 50% of the talking on the Secret Origins podcast is done by a terrific guest from the podcast and blogging community. So check out the Secret Origins podcast, available on iTunes and at secretoriginspodcast.wordpress.com.
Now back to G.I. Joe.
And welcome back. Now let's go ahead and go into episode 5 of G.I. Joe, the animated series.
Yo, Joe!
We'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there.
G.I. Joe, American hero. G.I. Joe is there.
It's G.I. Joe against Cobra and Destro, fighting to save the day. He never gives up, he's always there, fighting for freedom over land and air.
G.I. Joe, American hero, G.I. Joe is there.
G.I. Joe is the code name for America's daring, highly trained special mission force. Its purpose, to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
He never gives up. He'll stay till the fight's won. G.I. Joe will dare.
G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe.
All right. Concluding the first miniseries, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, Part 5, A Stake in the Serpent's Heart, originally aired Friday, September 16th, 1983 at 3 p.m. With their jet spinning inexorably to its doom, Scarlet and Destro work together to regain control and fly safely back to the Cobra base. Baroness tells Destro about Cobra Commander's attempt to destroy New York, and for this bungling, Destro says he's taking full control of all mass device operations. Scarlet, meanwhile, kicks the crap out of a bunch of Cobra troopers, but they eventually recapture her and throw her in a dank prison cell. There, Scarlet is attacked by the slave girl, Selina, and they fight because that's what women do in prison. Finally, Scarlet recognizes Duke's ring on Selina's finger, and the women agree to work together. Elsewhere, Destro gets fed up dealing with the kidnapped world leaders, and in his frustration, decides to use the mass device to eradicate New York City. Exactly what Cobra Commander tried to do, which only proves that it doesn't matter who is in control of Cobra, dealing with the United Nations is an insufferably annoying task. So Cobra fires its mass destruction ray at New York, and G.I. Joe decides to shoot their own mass ray at the same target, hoping to knock Cobra's destruction beam off course, because that's how science works. And that does, in fact, work. Destro gets mad and takes things to a new level, allowing to execute the prisoners every half hour until the world accepts his demands. Scarlet and Selena try to thwart Destro by leading a slave revolt, but they fail pretty miserably and get recaptured. At the G.I. Joe headquarters, the team decides to do what they should have done two episodes ago, unlock Duke's memories about his time in captivity. They put him in a Bacta tank, and Doc uses some hypnotic suggestions to go back through his memories, and we see what a great all-American fella Duke is. And then we see his memory of the Cobra Temple and the exotic slave girl to whom Duke gave his ring. The Joes realize they can trace the microcircuitry on the ring back to the Cobra base. The Joes' mass device teleports the entire team and all their vehicles to the Cobra's doorstep. And we get a nice big battle where the Joes overrun the Cobra's defenses. Scarlet, Selena, and the other prisoners are rescued. Cobra Commander, Baroness, and Major Blood are captured. But Destro sets his mass device to fire on Earth's core, which gives him just enough time to escape while the Joes destroy the device. In the aftermath, the Joes exhaust the mass device's elements, putting all of the captured armies and things back in their original spots. Well, almost. Breaker screws up and puts the Eiffel Tower of Paris in London, England. The episode ends with Breaker saying, "Nobody's perfect," and Duke saying, "No, but we do okay." Yo, Joe.
Ba 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 da ba. Yo, Joe.
So, Kyle, what do you think about this issue, or this episode?
Oh, it's still pretty fun and enjoyable, and it goes out with a bit of a whimper. I'm curious what their budget was like when they were putting together this, because it started out pretty sharp and crisp, and it seemed like the animation errors were a little bit more frequent in this one, a little more coloring errors, which you also see in the Transformers counterpart, which was the four-parter More Than Meets the Eye. When that came out, the animation was pretty crisp in that, but towards the end of that, you started to see a lot more coloring errors. I kind of wonder what their production schedule got a little rushed. Or what? Going through Duke's memories, that whole thing was kind of weird. They had a really weird coloring error in that. It's that there was like two blonde kids with the same green colored jacket, and then all of a sudden one of them moves and now has a blue colored jacket, and then punches the other one in the face. But they kind of had that weird, like, I guess they were trying to show that it's a dream or taking place in the past with the weird, like, time-lapsed images that they were going through instead of smooth animation. It was an odd choice, I guess. But one thing I did notice is while the whole Joe team is sitting there in kind of, like, the control room watching all that, the animators did stuff to keep the Joes kind of busy so you didn't just have, you know, a group of 15 guys standing there not moving. There's one part where a guy's biting into an apple. That was just kind of a neat little touch. Plot-wise, this chapter certainly didn't do Scarlet or Selena any favors, and they were definitely the kind of damsels in distress throughout the episode. Overall, it was still obviously enough and a pretty popular premise to warrant a follow-up miniseries before they launched, you know, a more lengthy season in season 3. So still enjoyable, still takes me back, and a lot of fun to watch.
Oh yeah, I like the flashback or the Duke sequence in the machine, you know, where they're doing the flashbacks to his childhood and all that. I thought that worked out kind of good the way they did that myself. I do like the part where Destro was about ready to pound on Cobra Commander. He may should have probably done that thing. It may have turned out a little bit differently, but yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, General Flagg's different here than he is in the comic.
He's,
am I correct on
he's
that?
He's different here than he is everywhere. Like, he... Yeah.
That's one thing that I don't know why, but yeah, somehow that just stuck out to me. That, yeah, he seemed very different here than what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. So, but then again, this was their first miniseries. And I'm not sure when this coincided with the comics, the Flag actually had much of a showing yet, I guess. I don't know. Overall, I enjoyed the cartoon, this episode. Like Kyle was saying, it started out really strong, and the end was still good. It was still enjoyable, but it wasn't.
I felt like there were some pacing issues with this one. Like,
maybe that's what.
Maybe the story didn't need to be 5 episodes. I kind of felt like they sort of exhausted, and like the first half of this episode was fairly repetitive. Okay, Destro shuts down Cobra Commander. He's like, I'm going to be in charge. And then he starts doing the exact same things that Cobra Commander was doing. And he gets, I mean, he kind of snaps and he, you know, he says, I'm going to just straight up murder these hostages every half an hour until you do. That's okay. That's, we're taking this to a new level. But I enjoyed the final battle. Like once we see all of the Joes and their gear in action, it felt appropriate to have to throw all of our toys into the mix. During that final confrontation, something I noticed, it's one of the very few times, maybe the only time, when we see Torpedo out of his wetsuit. There's a moment where you just see him wearing like a plain white t-shirt and like navy blue pants.
Yeah.
And other than that, I mean, we'll see this when we get into our coverage of The Revenge of Cobra, but a lot of elements from this first series are repeated in the second one. Lines of dialogue are used again. For instance, the final exchange in this one, the nobody's perfect, no, but we do okay. That same bit of dialogue is used again in the next miniseries. But, I mean, overall, I like this five-part miniseries. It was a fun introduction to the characters. I agree with Kyle, like, Scarlet, they seem to elevate her to a pretty important piece for most of the series, and then in this last one, I mean, she's in it a lot, but she's not really being served as best she could.
She started out kicking some butt in it, but then,
yeah.
Quickly became, yeah, like Kyle said, the damsel in distress, and...
Yeah.
And, yeah, thinking about it, something wasn't quite right, and I think that's what it is, what you said earlier there, Ryan, that maybe it just stretched out a little bit too far, may have been better suited to be a four episode instead of the five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of makes me wonder. This would have rolled out before Transformers did. I think I said Transformers was four earlier. It might only have been three when they rolled that out, the More Than Meets the Eye. I think that was just
a three-parter.
But yeah, I'm kind of curious why they went with five on this one, but they go with five again in the follow-up one, correct?
Yeah.
Season two, so they thought that was the magic number.
Five-parters were sort of default for G.I. Joe whenever they did their big, like, mini-events or mini-movies.
That's right. Arise, Serpentor, Arise was a five-parter, too. Yep.
Yeah, the Pyramid of Darkness, Revenge of Cobra, even, like, when you get into, like, the later seasons, like, with Operation Dragonfire, the
man,
movie...
When the movie was
syndicated, it was divided into five parts.
Yeah. Yep, that's true, yeah.
What were you going to say?
If only they would have made Cold Slither a five-parter.
We will get to that eventually. We will get to that.
Yeah, I don't know if that would have worked.
Season 3, episode 51. Can't wait.
You got that memorized.
Yeah, that's... I love that song. That's like when I'm in a shitty mood. When I'm in a crappy mood, I'll pull that up on YouTube and just watch like a 2-minute clip of it. And they're in the studio recording it, and the studio executive guy gets mad, which he's the same like director from the Transformers episode Hoist Goes Hollywood. And Cobra starts just kicking stuff and destroying it and saying that's what he wants, and socks the guy, and they just play louder. Oh, it's great.
The music too, without the vocal tracks, but that music is used in a Transformers episode or two.
Autobop, they use that. That's the nightclub episode where Soundwave, my favorite Transformer, is putting out the hypnotic tones that they enslave all those dancers and make them build construction work for the Decepticons. That episode's awesome, though, because outside of the movie, that's the only other time I think we see Soundwave and Blaster ever square off.
Yeah.
But that's another thing about this series is obviously they were both Marvel properties and being put out by Sunbow and Marvel Studios at the time, along with... Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, so you get the same background noises and the same voice actors throughout.
Right.
So,
oh, yeah.
Transformers is definitely my first love out of those three properties. So, like, if I'm playing any of the, I have a bunch of these recorded off of Discovery Kids. I think 294 on DirecTV plays them. So, I just had the series set to record, so I get pretty much all of them saved. But if I have them on or whatever playing in the background, and I'm not paying really attention. I hear a voice that was also used in Transformers, and that's the first thing that pops into my head.
Yeah, I've got a recording also for my daughter. She wants it recorded, so I'm recording all the G.I. Joes. I only keep it a handful at a time because I don't got room in my DVR, but yeah. I was just looking. Yeah, the first Transformers was 3 episodes. I keep thinking it's 5 episodes for some reason, but it was only 3 episodes for that More Than Meets the Eye, so.
Let's see. The Five Faces of Darkness, the miniseries that came out after the Transformers movie, that was a 5-parter.
Oh, that was such a good 5-parter, despite all the animation errors.
Yeah, and that was one of actually few 5-parters that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I think that was the only one.
Yeah,
usually Return of Optimus Prime was a 2-parter.
Yeah, they had either 2 or 3-parters for the most part when they had their big
season tweet. 4 was a 3-parter.
Reverse was a 3-parter.
Yep.
Well, that'll have to be a spin-off podcast.
But yeah.
The Vector Prime, where they build the aerial bots, that was a 2 or 3-parter.
Mm-hmm.
War of the Dinobots, that was a 2-parter, yeah.
Great, coming soon from Head Speaks, Transformers the Podcast.
if you really want to stick it to Shag, that's what you'll do, because he loves that Transformers comic series. When I met him in person, we only recorded for like a half an hour, but we hung out for like 3 or 4 hours and just talked about everything while we were going through this one comic book shop. And he talked about his love for that series for like a good 20 minutes.
Well, yeah, see, G.I. Joe's my first love, but Transformers is a close second. Yeah, Transformers is one of the G.I. Joe and the Transformers what led me into becoming the comic geek that I am, so. Right, here comes another podcast. Anyway, so let's get back to G.I. Joe.
Well, I will say, a Head Speaks Transformers cast would be the most appropriate since, you know, you did have the Headmasters.
Yes. Yes. Head Speaks presents Headmasters. All right.
So any final thoughts on the final episode of the original miniseries?
Like I said, this is what got me started in comics, got me started in G.I. Joe. I didn't get into the comics or the toys until later on. The animated series is what, again, that's my first love. And it all stemmed from this first 5 episodes. So even though, like we talked about, it got a little weak at the end, a little stretched out. Overall, I really enjoyed this entire series. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed this 5th episode as a part of that series just because, as a whole, it was a good series. And again, that's what got me, you know, here I am 30 years later, got a podcast on this, and, you know, 3 other podcasts, maybe a 4th one, another 5th one coming soon, that's besides the point. And, but yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. Kyle, any other thoughts on it?
Nope, pretty enjoyable, even though this one drug out a little bit, a little convoluted, a little long. Still had, more happen here in this, 5th episode than like an entire season of Dragon Ball Z, so that'll piss off some listeners. But still pretty enjoyable episode and a pretty enjoyable first series for the G.I. Joe animation. So really looking forward to season 2.
Oh, most definitely. All right, well, give me just a minute, guys, and we'll be right back.
G.I. Joe will return after these messages.
Hey, Gene, we should do a podcast.
Sounds like a great idea, Jeff, but what will we talk about?
How about a superhero that we both love?
Perfect. Someone like Thor or Captain America?
Both great choices, but I think they're being covered by somebody else already.
Wait, I've got it. What about the Protector of the Universe?
Like Voltron?
No. The guy with the jewelry that lets him create whatever he wants.
Ah, Green Lantern, nice.
Close. No, this guy has cosmic awareness.
Captain Marvel?
Almost. I mean, Quasar.
Ah, Quasar. Who doesn't love a good Quasar?
Tune in to the Quantum Cast, covering all things Quasar.
Yes, that's right. You can find us at quantumbands.blogspot.com.
And on the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network.
Yeah, that didn't sound scripted at all, did it?
Hi, I'm Kyle Benning, and I love comics. In fact, I love them so much that I ramble on about them on a number of podcasts, all on one feed, found under the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun banner. I talk about comics with extra page counts, like Treasury Comics, prestige format books, DC's Dollar Comics, Marvel's Giant Size Specials and King Size Annuals, and much, much more. I also love to talk about DC's Crisis on Multiple Earth crossovers, free comics from special promos, free comic book day, Star Wars, my life as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan, random comic book back issues, and many other elements of geek culture that happen to strike my fancy. There's new content usually dropping at least once a week, and it's all found on one feed. You can subscribe via iTunes. Just search for King Size Comics Giant Size Fun in the iTunes Store or podcast app on your iPhone. Otherwise, you can follow the podcast at the King Size Comics Giant Size Fun blog headquarters, available at www.kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com. That's all one word, kingsizecomicsgiantsizefun.blogspot.com. Or follow on Facebook by simply searching for King Size Comics Giant Size Fun. So for snappy review and discussions on comics, new and old, usually done from the front seat of my car or my lunch break at work, check out King Size Comics Giant Size Fun.
Now back to G.I. Joe.
Welcome back. Here we go with Postbox the Pit. First up, let's go take a look at the Twitters. Kyle, you got Twitter there?
Yeah, we got Twitter likes and favorites, I guess favorites and retweets, from Sin, John Francis, Cord Industries, Willie Yarbrough, Connell, Firestorm Fan, and FKA Jason.
Again, that is it on Twitter at G.I. Joe, Royal American Headcast. And then we're also on Facebook. And Mr. Daly, would you like to read off the Facebooks?
Yeah, Facebook likes and shares came from Kim Tai, Giuseppe Ferragamo, Gene Hendricks, Jeremy Richard, Gotham Shioran, Kyle Knox, Kevin Raider Nerd Reitzel, Jim Beard, Earth Destruction Directive, and Doug Miller.
Very good. And emails, this time only had one email from our buddy Jeff Nelson. He sent this on February the 3rd. He says, "Hey guys, I missed a month thanks to Retail Hell, followed by Inventory. So I binged on the last two episodes. Not much to comment on issue 5. The issue was pleasant enough, if a little goofy. I did enjoy the cartoon discussion, as you guys were having a lot of fun. However, it was the interview of Jim Beard that most caught my interest. I'm also a fan of the G.I. Joe Adventure Team era, having had the blonde pilot, Joe, in the Adventure Team headquarters, the only time I ever had a cool action figure playset. That brought back a lot of memories of it and other toys of the era, like Mattel's Big Jim and the later Wolfpack, the Mego superhero dolls in Star Trek and Planet of the Apes, and the $6 million man Evel Knievel lines. All great toys that simulated imagination. Episode 6 covered part 1 of my favorite stories of the handful of Joe comics I collected. The Afghanistan adventure was topical and a nice change of pace. Large parts of it did feel like commercials for current and upcoming toys. I was surprised to hear you mention that the RTV was not turned into a toy, as it seemed the main purpose for showcasing it. It was a cool design, though, as you guys say. You wonder how they assembled it in 23 minutes. My co-workers, all naval officers and chief petty officers, and I had to put together a large army tent, like the size you would use for outdoor catering, and it took us a heck of a lot more than 23 minutes, and that had no mechanical parts. The real fun of this issue was meeting the Joe's Soviet counterparts, the October Guard. They are stereotypical, as things tend to be in comics, but memorable. Everything about them and said Soviet. Even as some of the weapons were outdated, and elements of the uniforms were a bit off, like Stormovik's gray color, which would be a light blue for Airborne. None of that mattered, as there were the images you would see on Soviet propaganda posters and newsreels, the brave red army with their iconic tanker's padded helmet, the Airborne blue and white striped shirt, and the PPSH-41 submachine gun, Starvik's weapon. Everyone knew an AK-47 on site, even if the Red Army was using the AKM. About the only thing missing was the Red Army helmet and a wool great overcoat. The plot, especially the ending, reminds me a bit of the Rat Patrol episode, The Chain of Death Raid, where patrol warrior Troy and the German commander Dietrich were captured by Arab slavers and must work together to escape. Due to the haphazard nature of comic book distribution on a few newsstands at the time, it would be several years before I got to see the conclusion of the story. The issue wet your taste buds, but that one gave you a real meat and a feast of action it is. But that's for next episode. As for the cartoon, I recall very little, except the miniseries felt like a pro wrestling match, where the villain sticks it to the hero for much of the match, before the hero finally makes his comeback. for me, I was ready for that, the third episode. I was kind of turning out by the fifth, which is probably why I didn't watch the cartoon that much. Well, that and the college workload. I do have to say that I wish the live-action movie had been more like a cartoon. Amen. As bloodless and silly as it could be, it usually had decent plots and plenty of action. The movie, only saw the first one, just kind of sat there for me. I almost get the feeling they're afraid to take it over the top and have fun with it, which really holds it back, in my opinion. Anyway, until Cobra Commander speaks in a clear and calm manner, take care, Jeff Donaldson. Well, Jeff, I have to agree with most of your thoughts there. It seems like, from your brief comments, you enjoyed 7 more than me and Ryan did. We'll find out when you write on that issue, in the current episode. Do you guys have any comments on any of Jeff's thoughts?
I stopped listening after he said it took longer for him and his buddies to put together a tent than it did for other Joes to put together a car. No, we're kidding. Thank you very much for writing in, Jeff.
Yeah.
Well, I think we made that comment last episode that we wish, you know, our mechanic worked as fast as the Joes did, you know. All right, well, there's nothing else. I guess that'll do it for this month. Ryan, why don't you tell these fine fellows and ladies at home where they can find you on the internets?
Oh, we don't have any lady listeners.
This is true. Not even my wife listens to this. That's another. Anyways, Ryan, where can we find you?
Well, if any men or women or females, or as Professor Allen calls them, persons of ladiness, were to listen to this and wanted to hear more from me, you can find me on 3 podcasts: the Secret Origins podcast, Power of Fishnets, a Black Canary and Zatanna podcast, and Give Me Those Star Wars, all 3 of which are part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, which can be found at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
And Kyle, where can the people find you at?
I have a handful of different podcasts covering a number of different topics like Giant Size Comics, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Golden Age Stories, and more, all available at my headquarters, King Size Comics, Giant Size Phone, .blogspot.com. It's also available on iTunes. And I have a new show that's 3 episodes now in. That is the Superman and Captain Marvel Power Hour podcast, where I take a look at my 2 favorite DC characters, which are Superman and the original Captain Marvel, originally published by Fawcett and then licensed by DC in the 70s before they acquired full ownership there in the late 80s. And so far, I've just been going through the Superman from the 30s to the 70s collection and the Captain Marvel from the 40s to the 70s hardcover collection, and kind of just chronicling their adventures and growth as characters throughout the decades. So really enjoying that one. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, and well, you can find me, as usual, over on headspeaks.com. And I've got my litany of podcasts. We've got this one here. We have my Head Speaks, which is my primary podcast, where I talk about comics and all things geeky. We have Task Force X, where I talk about Suicide Squad and Checkmate. And then my newest one, the Starman Manhunter Adventure Hour, which the first episode should have dropped the week before this one. And then coming soon, possibly, Head Speaks presents The Transformers. We'll see about that. But then also, if you want to hear me and Ryan talk a little more, coming out probably the week before this drops on his Secret Origins podcast, episode 28, we talk about Nightshade from over on the Suicide Squad. Go hear me and Ryan talk a little bit about Suicide Squad and Nightshade and an artist that only made 1 or 2 appearances in the 80s, never heard from him again. Go check that out.
I wish.
Go check that out. But anyways, I guess I'll do it for this week, or this episode. Come back next episode when we talk about issue 8 and the first part of the second G.I. Joe miniseries. Until then, I guess that's it, guys. As usual, knowing is half the battle. G.I. Joe.
Yo, Joe.
We're not perfect, but we do our best.
We do okay.
We do okay. Damn it, I can't even get the damn saying right.
That's because you're not perfect.
That's right.
But you do all right.
No, it's not. You do all right.
All right, we're good. We're gone. Bye, everybody.
All right, all right. Take this. Scrap this whole episode from the top. From the top.
All right, well, one more time. This time with filling, guys. Bye, everybody.
Boy, what a great campsite!
Yeah, here's more wood for the fire.
No, my poles are on fire! Run for the stream!
Don't run! Here, let me wrap this around you. You okay?
Lucky thing you were around, Spirit.
Lucky thing you didn't run. Remember, running only makes the fire worse. If your clothes catch fire, wrap yourself in a rug or blanket.
And roll on the ground to smother the flames. Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
G.I. Joe, a Real American Headcast, is available monthly on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Headspeaks.com. All characters and stories are owned and trademarked by their respective owners. We claim no ownership other than our opinions. All audio and images are used for entertainment purposes and falls under fair use. We make no money from this headcast. For more of the monthly G.I. Joe, check out the IDW series. For the stories we're covering, look for the comics and trade paperbacks. Let us know what you think. Send us an email letting us know your thoughts. Joe's dismissed.
We're Cold Sliver. You'll be joining us soon. A band of vipers playing
on tune. No, cut! It's all wrong. This is art, not exploitation. All right, let's do it again from the top.
Back to one.
And feel your motivation.
How long are we gonna put up with this banger?
Only until we're paid.
Excuse me, sir, but we are now into overtime and the union rules specifically state...
The only union they should be concerned with is the one between their heads and their shoulders.
Yes, sir.
Places, everyone!
Okay, let's try it again. Action!
Action! Everybody!
Soon, a band of vipers playing our tune. With an iron fist and a reptile hiss, we shall rule.
What is that idiot doing?
We've heard it before. We're not gonna play the game no more. Don't tell us what's right.
They are animals.
Too late to resist, cause Cobra is strong.
Oh my goodness, we're going way over budget.
We're
barbarians!
Heavy